From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Is President Obama passive in foreign affairs? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The president is accused of standing by as Egypt's generals deposed an elected government and killed almost 1,000 opponents, both in the streets and in custody. Promised aid to Syrian rebels has not materialized months after Mr. Obama's demand that President al-Assad step down. Iran's new president reportedly wants direct negotiations, but the U.S. failed even to congratulate him on his recent election. Is it too late for the U.S. to have an impact on crises in the Middle East? Have opportunities been missed? Or did they really exist in the first place? Today's talking point, sexual harassment and politics in San Diego. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warman Alney back with To the Point. Egypt's ruling generals have thumbed their noses at the U.S. There's been almost no American help to rebels in Syria. And Iran's new president is getting the cold shoulder, despite evidence that he wants to talk. Is President Obama conducting a passive foreign policy, or is he being realistic about this country's influence in the Middle East? Today's talking point, San Diego's new mayor said he'd return to his office today after 2 weeks of therapy for sexual misconduct. Can angry opponents force him to step down? First, this news update from Cairo. Egypt's ruling generals say 36 Islamists were killed trying to escape from custody in the past few days. A court has reportedly acquitted former President Hosni Mubarak of corruption charges and ordered that he be set free. After a week of violence that killed almost 1,000 people, what's it like on the streets of Cairo? Mike Giglio is Middle East correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. Mike, good to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Have you been able to get out onto the streets very much in Cairo?
Right now, after 7, no, it's curfew here, pretty strongly enforced. But today, I was out and about, and so were a lot of people, and it was strange, actually, after what we saw this weekend, that there was some sense of very tentative calm today.
A tentative calm. Did people expect that to last?
I don't think they do. I think they're bracing for more, and it's just not clear where this goes next. So I think, you know, people were going about their business as they could today. Stores were opened, and people are kind of just waiting for whatever the next round of chaos is going to be.
What about the Muslim Brotherhood? Have they been heard from? Are they all underground or in detention?
A lot of them are underground and in detention. I mean, and their leaders especially are just off the map. And, you know, they have promised that this week was going to be a week of continued protests starting yesterday. But there were, you know, the rallies planned yesterday, a few of them were canceled, and the ones that did go ahead were very small, and today was quiet again. So I think that they're really struggling to come up with a response to the violence that they saw this weekend.
How does today's situation compare to what you saw last Friday?
You know, on Friday, I was out right, you know, as curfew hit, and even as most people cleared the streets, there were still a lot of people staying out there to keep fighting. I was on the anti-Islamist side for a while, and you heard gunshots, and you saw people coming off the front lines just full of buckshot from shotgun blasts. You know, and there were just regular people fighting alongside police. So it was definitely that sense of chaos that lasted until Saturday. You had the siege of a local mosque here. And then just today, it's finally the first day where we didn't have any new outbreak of violence.
Mike Giglio again in Cairo for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. The Egyptian government has justified detaining and killing leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood by calling them terrorists. There have, in fact, been attacks on Coptic Christian churches. Matt Bradley is Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He joins us from Minya in Upper Egypt. Matt Bradley, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
What have you seen up there?
Well, we've seen several churches that have been just torched by, and even actually one sort of a children's nursery that was run by a Christian organization that were torched by Islamist supporters of President Mohamed Morsi, who was ousted in early July.
How do we know that it was Morsi supporters who did the torching?
We don't know exactly. And in fact, that's something that Morsi's supporters and members of the Muslim Brotherhood are saying, is that, you know, this has been done by the police. And they point to some evidence that these were not very well protected, that the military and the police and even the fire department in many of these cases didn't show up on time. They also note that nobody really died in any of these church burnings, and there were something like 35 across the country. So they're saying that this was a coordinated attempt to try to defame the Muslim Brotherhood at the same time that the military and the police were gunning down Muslim Brotherhood leader members and supporters of Mohamed Morsi to the tune of more than 600 deaths in Rabah Adawiyah Square and Nahda Squares in Cairo last Wednesday.
Are there curfews in effect in the Christian communities that are not in Cairo?
Yes, the curfew is a mostly nationwide curfew. So there's curfew here in Minya, and in fact, it's very strictly enforced here because of the violence that occurred.
Is the military taking part in making sure that you and other journalists see what's been happening in these Christian communities?
Well, the military and the interim government has been extremely disappointed and very vocal about their disappointment in the coverage of the last 2 months. And in fact, they've come out and said, they've come out at press conferences and given out lists of the churches that have been torched. They've been complaining to journalists that they're focusing too much on the really hundreds of deaths among the Morsi supporters and not enough on the violence that has been committed by the Morsi supporters, particularly toward Christians. And some of the things that Christians here have been saying is that, look, we have been victims of violence. We are upset by the attacks by Islamists. But at the same time, the overtures made toward the Western media and toward the West in general by this interim government are disingenuous. They say that this government doesn't care any more about Christians than the Mubarak regime that was ousted in February 2011.
So obviously a chaotic situation all over Egypt, including in Minya, in the upper part of the country, where once again there is this conflict about Coptic churches. Thanks, Matt Bradley, very much for being with us, a Middle East correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. We'll be back in a moment with Mike Giglio in Cairo for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. We'll talk with him and others about alleged passivity on foreign policy by President Obama on To the Point from PRI.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream, featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're only back with To the Point. Mike Giglio just told us what it's like in Cairo today after a week of bloody violence. Stores are open. People were in the streets, although the curfew is underway now. But everybody is braced for more violence, and he's described it as a tentative calm. He's also investigated Egypt's new man in charge, the shadowy former intelligence officer, General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Mike Giglio, welcome back.
Thank you.
We first heard about General al-Sisi when President Morsi put him in charge of the military. What more have you been able to learn about him?
So, you know, from when we first heard about General Sisi until recently, until now, you know, we still know very little about who he is. His career is known, his resume is known broadly, but details of his service and especially details of his family are very sparing. And what I found was, while investigating, you know, his family history, just trying to put together basic details for a profile, there was extreme image control and narrative control going on from his side, and a real hesitance to have any of that come to light, even though there's nothing scandalous about it.
You did learn about his father in particular, who apparently was an artisan of great note.
That's right. He comes from an amazing family, actually. He's in a very historic area of Cairo called Gamaleya, which is a lot of tourists' initiation into Egyptian life. And his father was a very respected mother of pearl artisan. and he kind of pioneered the trade here in Cairo. And he was very well admired by General Sisi and by General Sisi's two brothers and by the community. So it clearly had an effect on him.
Has General Sisi ever fought in a war?
No, he hasn't. He joined the Army in 1973. He joined the Army College, and so he would have graduated after Egypt was in its peace period.
So he then has been in the Army at a time when it's been focusing not so much on military activity, but rather on economic activity.
That's right. You know, the Army is very profitable for its senior officer corps and retired generals and things like that. And also, it's very involved in the economy here. It has industries in agriculture. It builds the roads. And that's been a big part of its focus in recent years.
So what does this tell us about his current role, or what can you tell us about his current role? There he stands at the podium with his sunglasses, reminding people of not only President Mubarak, but Gamal Abdel Nasser of many years ago.
You know, I think the Nasser comparison is pretty important right now. And, you know, even with the family mystery, you know, we didn't know who Nasser's father was until a few years after he became president. And it's not of any shame or scandal. It's just the sense that he wants that part of his life kept out of the public spotlight. And I think in General Sisi's case especially, he wants to be known, as far as I can tell from his confidants and from people around him, is that he wants to be known by June 30th. He wants to be known by, you know, overthrowing Morsi after these popular protests, and he wants to be seen in the light of the person who came to the rescue of the country.
Does he want to be in charge of the country? Does he want to make himself a president, or is he serious about some sort of transition to civilian rule?
You know, it's not in the article, but I had an extremely interesting conversation with his spokesman over the course of reporting it. And his spokesman was adamant, as General Sisi has been, that in the upcoming elections, he will not run for president, and I think that's probably true. However, when you ask if he might run one day in the future, the answer becomes a little bit murkier. And I know that's harder for them to say, but I think it at least shows you that this is a consideration. He said in the past, and he said to me, you know, if he did retire from the Army in the future and run for president, that's within his legal right to do so. And, you know, I don't know if there's a decision made on that, but it's definitely a possibility as far as I'm concerned.
Again, Mike Iglio, Middle East correspondent for Newsweek and the Daily Beast, joining us today from Cairo. There's been extensive reporting on U.S. efforts to persuade General Sisi to negotiate a deal with the Muslim Brotherhood that might have avoided the deadly violence. But Sisi continued to thumb his nose at Secretary of State John Kerry, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, Republican Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham. William Dobson is politics and foreign affairs editor for Slate.com. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Should say you're also author of The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. Very relevant book, it would seem, at this point. Apparently, the Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, was on the phone with General Sisi 17 times in calls that led up to an hour and a half sometimes.
That's right. I mean, you can fault the Obama administration in one way or another, but what you can't fault is that they were deeply engaged and trying to work the contacts they have with the military, really substantially in the most recent weeks. But this is actually something that's been going on well back to 6 weeks ago, up even before July 3rd and the ouster of President Morsi.
But does this in and of itself, the fact that they worked so hard with the generals, is it evidence that they really have decided to come down on the side of the generals rather than the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, I think it's a fresh question even at this point, you know, because it becomes their policy right now, which is to stand with the generals clearly, and that they're not actually putting our aid, which is at the heart of our relationship with Egypt, in jeopardy, that hasn't been suspended or cut off. You know, it is the case that you could say objectively that they are still maintaining relations with the government, which is at this point Egypt's generals. Now, that position becomes harder to maintain as the violence in Cairo and elsewhere continues, as the body count increases. Pressure on the administration will rise to take a second look at its policy and its choices that it's made to date. I mean, I think the criticism that you're already seeing is that they have been very slow, despite maybe these, backroom efforts to put pressure, that they've been slow to send a signal to the generals that they would view what has happened in the last 7 days as putting the relationship on ice. You know, the generals clearly, despite all those conversations, made a calculation, and you could say at this point made the correct calculation, that they would not pay a price, a significant price, for ignoring the administration's advice and charging forward as they have.
Now, in other words, they don't believe that the aid will be canceled, or do they believe they'll get more aid from somebody else?
Well, I mean, you know, this all sort of sets the backdrop of sort of how much influence the United States really has in Egypt today. I mean, there's been a lot of criticism, and it came out very quickly that President Obama was somehow losing Egypt. That, in my opinion, at least, that's a fairly ridiculous thing to say. You know, President Obama can no more dictate events in Cairo or Egypt than any president really could. The question really becomes, how has he used the leverage that he had? Did he have any? It's an academic question right now as to whether or not suspending the aid earlier would have caused the generals to pause or to think differently about it. As you allude, it's the case that we're not even the greatest provider of aid to Egypt at this point. It's getting more aid from Gulf states, to the tune of almost 8 times more aid from Gulf states than what we're providing. But what we didn't do is ultimately sort of suspend this key element of the relationship. And to some degree, the generals might have looked at that and said, you know, we don't believe that they're willing to go that far. We have this much room. Let's take it. And at this point, they're right.
Back to Mike Giglio with Newsweek and the Daily Beast. Oh, I'm sorry, Mike Giglio is gone. The question I was going to ask him, William Dobson, I can put to you as
sure.
Well. And that is, does it appear that the generals act in what they think is their own interest, regardless of what it means for the United States?
Well, I think that's a fair assessment. Yes, I mean, and I think that is really the broader critique you could make against the administration is that, you know, when President Obama, and then we saw this, and even in his statement from Martha's Vineyard last week, you know, when he talks about Egypt and when he talks about many of his foreign policy initiatives, he talks about it in terms of interests. You do not, you know, you get the sense sometimes that interests, the last 8 years had a greater effect on his thinking, meaning the Bush administration years had a greater effect on his thinking about foreign policy than maybe anything else, because he seems very reluctant to cast these questions in moral terms. He wants to ground them in a careful calculation of interests. And so he, you could argue, is making the bet that the side that's going to triumph is the side that he wants to remain with, in this case, Egypt and the generals. Now, the generals, I would argue, are acting on their interests as well. And now, you know, the criticism of Obama is whether or not he is doing the same. That if you look at the situation and you say, you know what, actually our leverage is very limited here, then it might be a good moment to say, well, then we should act on our values. And our values right now are greatly at odds with the policy, because we are at this point maintaining a relationship with a government that has just orchestrated the bloodiest crackdown that anyone has seen since Tiananmen Square.
Again, William Dobson is a politics and foreign affairs editor at Slate.com. Corey Shockey is a fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, former director for defense strategy at the National Security Council. That was during the George W. Bush administration from 2002 to 2005. Good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren.
Would you say that President Obama has lost Egypt?
No, I think I agree with William's judgment that our influence is on the margins of the choices that are going on in Egypt. And as Jim Mattis, the former CENTCOM commander, likes to say, a country fighting a total war can defeat us fighting a limited war. And the same is true for diplomatic influence. The Egyptian generals clearly feel that this is an existential crisis that they're managing, and they don't want to hear it from us. And I agree with William's very good point that they made a shrewd calculation that has so far proved right, which is that we will make them pay no significant penalty for the choices that they're making. Where I disagree with William is that President Obama actually does use normative language when he's talking about many of these crises. He may make tentative, passive choices, but he talks like a preachy liberal. Assad must go. The kinds of things he said about the Egyptian general's crackdown are actually consistent with our values. It's just that our policy isn't consistent with what he's saying. And I do think that has limited our influence further in Syria, in Egypt, in Iraq, and in other places.
Elaborate a bit on the preachy liberalism from President Obama. What other examples do you have in mind?
Well, you know, talking about the end of the Iraq war being, you know, a responsible withdrawal, and then averting our eyes from the rising civil war that's recurring in Iraq. I think the choices about identifying a red line in Syria and then trying to pretend that Assad hadn't crossed it. And then once Assad did cross it, the condemnation for it, but in fact very little action. The only policy difference is that we say we are going to begin arming the Syrian opposition, but that's problematic for reasons the administration's right to be concerned about. And so we say we're going to arm the opposition, but we don't actually give them any arms.
Corey Shockey again, formerly with the George W. Bush administration. William Dobson, back to you. Did President Obama come into office believing and having campaigned on the idea that the Bush administration went too far in both Afghanistan and Iraq?
Yes, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think that I think there are a couple things that worked. One, I think that the world proved to be a more complex place than President Obama expected to find. I think that's one element, that the choices he's faced have actually been fairly difficult ones in many respects, and he has often opted for the route that involves not making a choice. I think that's one. And I do think that he saw, in fact, whether it be liberal, conservative, or what have you, I think that he thought the rhetoric out of the previous administration was more preachy I agree with everything that Corey said except for that element of the rhetoric. Maybe we hear what we want to hear in these things. I don't know, but you know, I think we'd agree that he doesn't act on it, however much he may or may not accent it in his rhetoric. And so what you found is a president who wanted very much to draw down America's involvement in the Middle East, and I think that's also a position that he was partially elected on. Americans have no appetite for another sustained engagement in the Middle East, and that's something that that the Obama administration inherits from the Bush administration.
So quickly, Corey Shockey, we need to go to a break relatively soon. We'll come back, of course, and let you finish your answer completely. But what about that point, regardless of the rhetoric? Isn't it true that there's no more appetite left in the United States for foreign interventions? What options does the president have?
I agree that my mom and other Americans are exhausted with how expensive in terms of time and effort and lives and money the Bush administration strategy for Iraq and Afghanistan and other engagements has been. The problem is that the Obama administration said it would take a different approach, but in fact it hasn't. And the soft power strategy, the active diplomatic engagement over time, actually is the approach that most Americans would back, and the Obama administration just hasn't been carrying it out.
Okay. Let me indicate again that Corey Shockey is former director for defense strategy at the National Security Council. That was during the George W. Bush administration. Now at the Hoover Institution, William Dobson is with Slate.com, author of The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. We'll be back with them, also with Barbara Slavin at the Atlantic Council's South Asia Center. On our talking point later on, we'll talk about San Diego Mayor Bob Filner, who has made clear he is not leaving anytime soon. There was some indication he would go back to his office today. We'll try to, after getting therapy for sexual misconduct, we'll find out what in fact happened. On To the Point from PRI.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Well, we're only back with To the Point, talking today about President Obama's foreign policy, particularly with regard to Egypt and also Syria. And I want to introduce Iran into the conversation as well. Barbara Slavin is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's South Asia Center. She's also Washington correspondent for ElMonitor.com. That's a new website about the Middle East. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much. Good to be back.
Tell us a bit about your analysis of what's happening with regard to Iran. You've said that's the one country in the Middle East where things might be better now than they were day before yesterday.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of ironic, isn't it? You know, the way this has moved from one country to another. Of course, Iran back in 2009 was replete with demonstrations against the fraud-tainted elections and so on, and it was talk that the regime wasn't going to last. And now, 4 years later, the Iranian government is looking rather happy with itself after the election of Hassan Rouhani, a technocrat cleric, as president, the exit of Ahmadinejad. And I was just in Iran, and I wouldn't say people are happy. They're very upset about the sanctions, the economic situation. They're very skeptical about what the new government can achieve. But when you compare Iran now to what's going on in Egypt, Syria, Tunisia, Libya, you know, the list goes on, it doesn't look so bad. And there's some diplomatic opportunities there for the United States that perhaps we don't see in Egypt, where U.S. leverage doesn't seem to be getting us very far.
Now, tell us what these opportunities are.
Well, you know, there is a new team. Rouhani is a former nuclear negotiator. His foreign minister just confirmed is a man named Javad Zarif, who was Iran's UN ambassador from 2002 to 2007, and was one of the authors of a 2003 so-called grand bargain offer for talks on a variety of issues between the U.S. and Iran, including the nuclear program, which in those days, of course, was in a very preliminary stage, not so now. But this is a very accomplished team. Zarif has spent half his life in the United States, and they say that they want to move quickly to restart negotiations on the nuclear issue, and that they understand that Iran will not see any relief of sanctions until there is some sort of nuclear agreement. So I would advocate that perhaps instead of wasting his time with the generals in Egypt, who appear to be ready to do just about anything they want, that Obama should put some more energy into the diplomatic track with the Iranians. He might actually get somewhere.
Rouhani has only been president for a brief time. What has the president of the United States done since?
Well, the president of the United States hasn't done enough. Again, I was there for the inauguration of Rouhani, and there were delegations from about 55 countries. There was no one from the United States. The most senior European was an ex-official, Javier Solana, who used to be the chief of foreign affairs for the European Union. I was told that had Obama sent a proper congratulations to Rouhani after his election, they might have invited some former American diplomats to attend the inauguration to have some consultations. The Obama administration is repeating a mistake which has been committed by many U.S. administrations, going back really to the Clinton administration, which is that it keeps trying to distinguish between the Iranian people and the Iranian government. Now, in some cases, that's fair, but with Rouhani's election, the U.S. Repeatedly congratulated the Iranian people on participating in the elections. They've never congratulated Hassan Rouhani. And if you want to negotiate with someone, especially if you want him to give up a good bit of Iran's nuclear program that it's paid so much in blood and treasure for, it might be nice to actually congratulate the guy on winning an election.
Barbara Slavin, again, at the Atlantic Council and ElMonitor.com. Corey Shockey, back to you at the Hoover Institution, formerly with the George W. Bush administration. Is this an example of passivity on the part of the Obama administration, or in this case, are they doing the right thing?
No, I agree with Barbara. I think that the administration's missing an opportunity. The last Iranian election in 2009, which was stolen with such breathtaking arrogance by the so-called conservatives in Iran, was an example of passivity. The Obama administration had very little to say about, you know, the Iranian people's rights in that instance. And here you had what appears to be a clean election, somebody who is a mainstream conservative candidate but was did not appear to be the choice of the Supreme Leader. And we should celebrate that the process worked and congratulate the winner, and just as we did when the Muslim Brotherhood came to power in Egypt. So I agree that there's a lot more we could do. We should be being a lot more active. And just to one more time bring up the Egypt case, when the Constitution was ratified in Egypt, it's not a constitution I would want to live under, but the public did turn out and validate the new constitution, which the military has now overthrown. We had much too little to say about the process of institution building and democracy building and rewards to civil society and rewards to leaders when they play by rules.
Quickly, Corey Shockey, back to Iran. Wouldn't the president have been attacked by Republicans if he had congratulated the president of Iran, regardless of what his policies might be, even though it would appear that he was elected freely and fairly rather than having it the whole thing stolen?
Well, I wouldn't have, you know, I wouldn't have taken him to task. I think a whole lot of other conservatives and a whole lot of other Republicans would have seen the opportunity for a fresh start. If we can have a reset with Putin's Russia, we can certainly attempt a reset when somebody who is saying the kinds of things that emphasize our common values gets elected in Iran.
Barbara Slavin, back to you. Hasn't the United States pretty much demonized Iran for a long time? Wouldn't it be difficult for the public to accept the kind of thing that you suggest?
Well, of course it would, but I mean, leadership is conditioning the public, and we're not talking about falling into each other's arms. We're talking about respectful nuclear negotiations. And in congratulating Rouhani on his victory, I mean, certainly you could put the usual caveats about how the process was not as free and fair as we would like, and of course the number of candidates, the type of candidates, is very much limited in Iran. There would have been a way to phrase it, you know, that would have been, I think, more proactive than the way the administration did. Their statements on most issues sound like they're written by committees, frankly, and not by human beings. But I appreciate what Corey said. I mean, this is an administration that somehow, it is timid. It just simply doesn't take action when action is called for, whether that's a strong statement about a human rights violation. It waits. It kind of tests the water. It sticks its finger in the wind. And I would like to have seen, frankly, more activity on the part of the Obama administration a year ago on Syria. We lost a chance to help shape and support a responsible opposition a year ago before all these jihadis were running around there. We have been very careful with the Egyptians, and we have lost leverage now. Essentially, the Saudis and the Emiratis have paid for this coup. And even if the U.S. does in the end cancel its $1.5 billion in aid, the Saudis, Kuwaitis, and Emiratis will more than compensate for that. I do think, though, with Iran in particular, you know, when you talk about the mood of the people, Egyptians seem to be so anti-American now. They have been for a long time. They blamed us for supporting Mubarak. Then they blamed us for supporting Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood. It seems like we can't put a foot right there. But with some gestures in Iran, I think the United States could maintain the popularity that it has among the Iranian people and really achieve some progress. And there would be benefits, not just in terms of the nuclear issue, but also perhaps in terms of Syria. We see now Lebanon is beginning to be destabilized. There are problems with bombs going off in Hezbollah territory and so on. And, of course, in the Arab-Israeli peace process, where any improvement in U.S.-Iran relations might also facilitate some movement there.
William Dobson, back to you. You said at the outset of this half of the program that things were much more complex from a foreign policy standpoint, and the choice is much more difficult than President Obama had anticipated. Is he, for example, by allowing Secretary of State Kerry to emphasize the peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians, which most people don't think are going to provide any progress at all, is he sort of working on the wrong things?
I think you could definitely make that case. I mean, you get the sense sometimes, I agree with everything that has just been said by both Barbara and Corey. I mean, you get the sense that we're living in the Middle East is living in a very tumultuous moment in its history. I mean, you think about the last 2 years and what that has brought to the region, the amount of change and tumult and turmoil that has come up, and not all of it, at least necessarily initially bad, but it's turning quite sour. And again, I don't think that you can lay all of that at the White House's doorstep, but it is the case that they have been slow walking one problem after the next. That in the case of Egypt, we have been so slow to condemn that which is clearly wrong when it occurs that we don't really ever have any credibility when we ultimately do condemn it. And it's been like a revolving door as we've seen change there, and we've always you can forgive the Egyptian people to some degree for not knowing which side we're on. Cairo is a city with conspiracy theories like none other, but you know, in some cases we've given them nothing that even approaches clarity in our position. I mean, it is the sense that we are backing those who are in charge when they're in charge. And in the case of Iran, I think some of the criticism of the United States in 2009 was misplaced, but the administration was slow to speak. And in this case, what we're talking about here is something very different. This is an instance where, at the government-to-government level, at an elite political level, the United States can actually have a role to play in many of the ways that Barbara has suggested, and we're foregoing that opportunity. In the case of Syria, again, there was a time when there were people on the ground that were probably worth arming, but we have run the clock out on Syria so that now when the administration eventually does come around to a position that says it might be open to the possibility of arming those, we look and we find the good guys are no longer there, if they were there at all. We don't know. Again, it's sort of lost to history.
Corey Shockey, is this, do you think, to some extent a reaction to what happened during the Bush administration that you were a part of, both in Iraq and in Afghanistan, in a sense that we need to be more realistic about what we can actually accomplish? We need not to get involved in nation building with all of the resources that requires. You pointed out yourself that people are exhausted by all of that, and that it's better to just sort of wait it out because that's being more realistic about what influence we can really exert.
Well, those aren't the only two options, obviously. I agree with your assessment of the mistakes we made in the Bush administration. But again, the Obama administration made those exact same mistakes in Afghanistan. It is pursuing in Afghanistan the strategy and that the Bush administration pursued in Iraq, and Americans are exhausted with that too. And so there's not just a you have to do it this way, so resource and time and effort intensive, or do nothing. There's a whole spectrum of opportunities in the middle. And what I had hoped the lesson the Obama administration would take from our mistakes in the Bush administration was active engagement early on to shape how problems evolve over time. And as I think both William and Barbara have emphasized, Syria is a perfect example of where a problem that was initially difficult, and yet there were options for involvement that would help create a better outcome. We did nothing. The problem metastasized worse and worse, and now it's hard to see where there are any good options. The passivity foreclosed better outcomes.
Is there still, Barbara Slavin, a chance to rescue the opportunity that exists in Iran?
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, that is the good news. We will have more nuclear talks probably next month. The new president and certainly his foreign minister will be coming to the UN General Assembly, and there'll be many opportunities for meetings there. I would hope that there is some really creative thinking now going on both sides quietly about what at least a confidence-building measure on the nuclear issue could look like. The Iranians desperately need sanctions relief, and if the United States could start to wind back the Iranian program, I mean, just think of what the benefits would be in terms of calming the Israelis down, calming the Saudis and the other Arabs across the Persian Gulf, and even perhaps influencing our own Congress, which seems never to have met a sanctions bill that it doesn't want to pass. And it could be a real achievement. It could be a real legacy for Obama. And right now, it's kind of hard to see any other area, certainly not Russia, China, Egypt, even the Arab-Israeli peace process, where Obama can look and say, look, this is something that I really achieved as president, something I achieved in my second term. And we know how American presidents like to have foreign policy legacies in their second term.
We heard earlier on the program how General Sisi in Egypt, how little was known about him until he took power. Nobody really knew what President Assad was going to do in Syria and when he took over from his father. You, Barbara Slavin, have interviewed now President Rouhani in Iran. Do we know more about him, and what is he like? What can we expect?
Yeah, well, I interviewed him actually in 2005 when he was Iran's chief nuclear negotiator, and I was part of a very lively press conference with him after his formal inauguration in Tehran, where I did manage to get in a question. We know a lot about him, actually. He's written three volumes of memoirs. I brought them back from Iran. They weigh about 16 tons, and I've given them to an Iranian friend to translate. Bits of them have been translated, but they haven't been translated in their entirety. He writes a lot about his efforts to negotiate a nuclear deal back between 2003 and 2005 when the Bush administration, you know, was setting preconditions for direct talks with the Iranians and so delegated responsibility to the Europeans to talk to Iran.
Let me just go back quickly. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to go quickly back to Corey Shockey because you were director of the defense strategy at the National Security Council during that time. What happened, and do you think there's hope for President Obama to establish a legacy with this new man?
Yes, I do think there is an opportunity now with someone elected in Iran who's not Ahmadinejad, but that has to be balanced against the fact that the Iranian government continues to be a state sponsor of terrorism. That doesn't mean we shouldn't negotiate with them. The Soviets were incredibly bad guys, and we held important, productive negotiations with them. You know, defining what our interests are and seeing if we can keep turning keys in the locks to find ways to achieve them is, I think, a good thing to do. But we need to be cautious about the fact that Rouhani is a guy who is successful and at the mainstream of a system that is the major state sponsor of terrorism in the world.
Barbara Slavin, what do you say to that?
Well, I absolutely agree, and I absolutely agree also that that's one of the reasons we need to talk to them, because if we hope to have any influence, we do need to talk, we do need to negotiate. It's very interesting. A lot of the Iranian discourse now in the elite circles are mentioning the word détente with the United States. Visions of the old Soviet Union. It used to be that they weren't allowed to use that word because, of course, we all know what happened to the old Soviet Union. It fell apart. And so people didn't like to talk about détente. But now that phrase is being used. You know, we have leverage with Iran. Actually, this is one policy of Obama's that has given us leverage. The sanctions are really, really hurting people. And Rouhani's election was a reflection of the fact that people did not want another hardliner, that they wanted relief, both domestically and internationally, from isolation.
Well, thank you all very much. That's all the time we have for this very interesting conversation. Barbara Slavin at the Atlantic Council, the South Asia Center there, Washington correspondent for AllMonitor.com. Corey Shockey at the Hoover Institution now at Stanford, formerly with the George W. Bush administration. Good to have you. And William Dodson, the politics and foreign affairs editor for Slate.com, author of The Dictator's Learning Curve, Inside the Global Battle for Democracy. Great to have you all, and thanks very much for being with us. Bob is stubborn, and he likes to fight. That's what one political consultant says about San Diego Mayor Bob Filner. He's been accused by 16 women of unwelcome sexual advances. One of them has sued him in court. A unanimous city council has demanded that he resign, and a recall campaign is underway. But Filner promised that he'd return to his office today after 2 weeks of therapy. We'll have an update in a moment on To the Point.
Check out our new YouTube video channel, The Q. KCRW DJs curate themed video playlists and feature artist clips straight from YouTube. Add some visual to your audio. Explore now at kcrw.com/theq.
Warman, I'll be back with To the Point. Bob Filner was elected last November, the first Democrat elected mayor of San Diego in many, many years. Not only that, he's a liberal Democrat in a relatively conservative city. He'd been in Congress for a long, long time. Now he has been, as I think everybody knows, almost assaulted by so many accusations of sexual misconduct. Here's one from Peggy Shannon, a 67-year-old great-grandmother who held a news conference last week.
On the day that Mayor Filner grabbed me and kissed me, I was so surprised. I went home and cried. I just felt so sad. I was just not sure how to take this contact, but it was very disturbing to me. On the day that Mayor Filner came by my desk and asked me if I thought he could go 8 hours in one night, I was shocked that he would say that to me.
Again, Peggy Shannon, 67-year-old great-grandmother, talking about the mayor of San Diego. Stephen Erie is professor of political science at the University of California at San Diego. Good, as always, to have you on our program.
Good to be here, Warren.
That's not kind of, not a thing you want people to be saying about you if you're the mayor of San Diego.
Well, the town's leading newspaper now called San Diego home to Groper by the Sea. 10 years ago, Enron by the Sea, now Groper by the Sea. That, unfortunately, is going to stick for a while.
So Mayor Filner has indicated that he might have stepped out of line from time to time. Once again, 16 women have accused him of the sort of thing we just heard from Peggy Shannon. One of them has gone to court, represented by Gloria Allred, who has been involved in a lot of cases of this kind. There's a recall effort against him, and all nine of the city council members want him to resign. What about this recall? Is it possible that
well,
might happen?
Warren, the thing is, the recall may be doomed to failure from the very beginning, because we never updated our city charter and our municipal code. It turns out that the recall provisions in the San Diego Municipal Code are almost the same as the state election code provisions that were declared unconstitutional after the Gray Davis recall. We've never got around to changing them, and it's all about your right to vote, whether you have to vote in the recall to be able to vote for the candidates to succeed Filner. Well, having said that, basically what's happening here is that if the city council is able to change the code next week, and then there's a second reading 30 days out, will you have to then start the recall all over again because you've started it right under the existing municipal code? I mean, this is a lawyer's full employment act at this point. Also, the recall, 101,000 signatures in 39 days. That's a very tall order. There have only been four or five recalls, and that's 15% of the registered voters. There's only been four or five in the country with 15% in that short period of time that have been able to successfully have a recall election. So it's a daunting challenge, to say the least.
You mentioned Gray Davis. He, of course, was the governor of California who was recalled and replaced by Arnold Schwarzenegger, who went on to be reelected and serve another term. So apparently there's not a lot of money behind this campaign either, and that would make it even more difficult to raise 101,000 signatures.
The word on the street is there's not a lot of money. But if you look at the key operatives in the recall campaign, the political consultant, the fundraiser, the communications director, and the treasurer, all of them are experienced Republican operatives who were actively involved, for example, in the 2012 City Pension Initiative, in the Jan Goldsmith, the city attorney's election campaign, Jerry Sanders' re-election campaign.
He's the former mayor.
And the former mayor. In other words, there's an awful lot of heft behind it. It may be volunteer on the front end, but there may be serious money, skin in the game, as they say, fairly quickly on. I mean, this is very serious business. In fact, the UT San Diego, the leading newspaper, has a section yesterday all about the recall. As organizers move into action, the UT recaps what voters need to know from legal notices to key facts and common questions, frequently asked questions, the process. I mean, this is almost a campaign document for the recall. I think they're going to have to file as an in-kind contribution.
UT San Diego making no bones about where it stands on all of this. I should tell our listeners that there are a couple of sources reporting to one of the television stations in San Diego that some sort of negotiation is going on at the moment with Bob Filner and with the city attorney, Jan Goldsmith, whom you mentioned, and with Gloria Allred, the attorney for the woman who has sued Mayor Filner. And another source says that a retired judge is, in fact, presiding over this mediation. One wonders what they would be talking about, Steve Erie. Would it be pretty uncomfortable to try to govern San Diego under these circumstances for Bob Filner, even though he wants to stick around?
I think it's going to be very difficult to govern, but I suspect what they're talking about is if Filner decides to resign, he's given no indication so far, but if he does, will the city pay for his legal fees and pay for damages in the civil lawsuit on sexual harassment? I think that's the essence of it. And as long as he stays in office, he has the leverage, right, to get that kind of deal. The problem is that the city attorney is there. The city attorney, Jan Goldsmith, and Bob Filner hate each other. The more that Goldsmith pushes, the more Filner pushes back. Goldsmith has now opined that Filner's expenses on the city credit card for pizzas, juicers, and expensive meals constitute, right, a sort of fraudulent misuse, right, of city funds, and therefore subject him, right, to removal by vote of the city council. So, I mean, they're grasping at straws at this point. The fact that Goldsmith is there is not necessarily a good sign in terms of a successful mediation.
Okay, and yet it would appear that perhaps the mayor does want to make some sort of compromise, and maybe there will be a resolution of this, and then we'll be talking about how they replace him, and I'm sure that might be a complicated matter as well. Anyway, we don't hear a lot about San Diego, a major city, of course,
right,
in California, and the news at the moment, politically at least, is not good. Always good to talk with you, Stephen Erie, professor of political science, University of California at San Diego.
Great to talk to you, Warren.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.